have a great show lined up. Our first guest is a gentleman I happen to see in the great HBO documentary called Student Athlete. This brother's name is Dr. Robert Turner, and Dr. Turner is the author of Not For Long, The Life and Career of the NFL Athlete. Dr. Turner played football at George Mason and went on to get his PhD at City University of New York, and is currently a professor at George Washington University. And Dr. Turner played in the old USFL and the CFL and spent some time in the NFL as well. So Dr. Turner has a great perspective from both sides. And let's just go right to our guest line and welcome this brother to the African-American Athlete Radio Show. Dr. Turner, welcome, my brother. You're on with Ricky Hampton and Michael Robinson. And it's a honor and a pleasure to have you join us tonight and talk about Not For Long. What was your inspiration to write this book?
Well, there's a number of things. First of all, let me just say thank you so much for allowing me to be on the air with you this evening. I'm really looking forward to having a lively discussion. And I think the thing that really pushed me to write this book was almost a little bit of a self-discovery, but then also knowing that there were so many other athletes out there who had had a difficult time in their transition to life after football. And I wanted to be able to give people the voice to tell their own stories. And so that's what, hopefully, that's what this book does through 140 interviews, along with spending 4 years in the field doing an ethnographic research project, as well as traveling across 8 different states.
Wow.
Yeah. All right.
Now, I happened to learn about your work as I was watching the documentary, The Student Athlete, and Dr. Turner, here at the African American Athlete, we are often in discussion about the role of the NCAA and its relationship, particularly with our young black athletes. How did that come about, and What were your thoughts about that documentary?
Well, it came about through a couple of people who were involved, Maverick Carter and Steve, you know, who were real strong friends with lifelong friends with LeBron James. They had seen Charmaine, who is the director, and they saw her giving a talk, and her work as a documentary filmmaker and a two-time Academy Award winner, her work is all about looking at social injustices and fighting for human rights. And so Steve walked up to Charmaine after she was talking once, giving a talk, and said, "We really want you to do a film about NCAA athletes." And Charmaine said she didn't know anything about it. She's from Pakistan. Her work was looking at the time. She had finished a film looking at how women were abuses towards women in Pakistan. And so what Charmaine did was reach out to Trish Dalton, who ultimately reached out to me because she had heard about my work with the book. And this was about 3 years ago. And asked, "I need to learn all about NCAA athletes. Can you explain to me what's going on?" And then through that, building a relationship and talking countless hours about what the movie could be about, what it should be about. And then I introduced her to Shamar Graves, who is in the movie, one of the featured athletes. And then the project took off from there. And so really, a lot of people, my thoughts are, a lot of people talk about should or should not athletes get paid. And I think exploitation, what we do in America is we often look at money and believe that money can solve problems. But if I ask people to look at the movie, and if the problems that you see we encounter in the movie, if you think that money can solve the problem, then I would ask you to look a little deeper. I think the problems are systemic, and I think they come from greed, but we need to change the whole system, not just throw money at the problem.
Dr. Turner, Shamar could use a little cash because he was working like 4 or 5 jobs. And, and as you said, hey, man, that's a big investment, and it really, and you barely live it.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, one time when I was, you know, younger, one of the pastors in a church I grew up with, he used to like to say, get rid of your stinking thinking. And Shamar is a great friend. I love him dearly. I spend a lot of time with him as much as I can. But he's stuck because I think the intervention that Shamar needs, yes, he needs money. Yes, he needs to be able to take care of his needs, which he can't clearly on four jobs. But what Shamar's intervention needed to happen when he was a young man, much, much younger, when he was in junior high school, entering into high school, before he got knee-deep into the sports industrial complex, to recognize that your identity, your worth, and how people relate to you is not based on what you do. It is a deeper sense of meaning of who you are. And I think that that's one of the traps that so many athletes can get caught up into, especially when you're looking at things like Nike throwing all this money around and schools making them feel like these athletes are kings while they're on campus, but then absolutely don't have a way for to help them transition to life after the sport is over.
Oh, that's very well said, and I totally agree. Michael, get you in on this conversation.
All right, Doc. Well, my question would be, in the classroom setting, is your book required reading, and do you also have any athletes in the classroom?
Well, I do have several people. I'm not teaching class this semester, as you might imagine.
Okay.
I'm doing a lot of
okay.
traveling between the book and between the movie. But I have a great friend who's I went to graduate school, and she's now a professor at Brooklyn College, Tamara Moose. And she is having this required reading. I'm also visiting a classroom tomorrow at Hunter College. And they are really focusing particularly on these issues around masculinity and sports and race in sports. And so I hope that my work does a great contribution in those areas, and looking forward to talking to college students on that level.
All right.
Hey, a conversation we had as we were setting up this interview, and I think you kind of touched on it, and I love what you said about, you know, sports isn't, doesn't make us, it's something we do. But do you think maybe historically in the black community that we have put a lot of emphasis in athletics? One reason why it was always a so-called way out of the, you know, poverty, and it gave us platforms to speak out on issues. If you look back over time, you know, black men have had platforms and been able to be successful in sports and entertainment.
Yeah, well, I mean, my work, what I tried to do with the book and the research that through my training is really build on the work of just a beacon of light and someone who we all owe a debt of gratitude to, and that's Harry Edwards. And Harry Edwards, Dr. Edwards, he says, and, you know, one of his central theses is that for the black community, particularly for black men, that sports, I'll borrow this term and I'll be very loose with it, but it's kind of a trap door where we put so much emphasis from our community and so many of our resources directed towards sports with so little return payout, is that it winds up draining many of our communities of people who could in turn, if they put the same type of energy into becoming doctors, lawyers, dentists, and, you know, great resources within our communities. And so what I do, going back to the question now about the athletes that I have in class, what I have historically had in class, one of the things that I really try to emphasize to these athletes, particularly African Americans and people of color and people who, even white folks who have come from backgrounds where, you know, they've been at disadvantage. But what I try to tell people is, listen, you have a great deal of talent, which is what got you here on this campus to play sports. But I bet you if you thought about it and you really looked at yourself, you have a multiple talents. You have all types of talents. You're going to be able to make great contributions well beyond sports. So I challenge my athletes in classroom to be like Leonardo da Vinci. And I ask the kids, do you know who Leonardo is? And most of them, they laugh, but they say, yeah, he's the guy who was in the Titanic. right? And I said, no, Leonardo da Vinci was a great sculptor, a great painter. He was a great artist. He was great in everything that he did, and he never limited himself to just be considered, you know, a sculptor or a writer or a painter. He was an inventor. And so that's what I challenge all of the young people in my classrooms is say, be great, but allow yourself to see yourself more than just this one thing, because those things that make you great on the football field or the basketball field, if you learn how to translate those talents into other areas, you will be great there as well.
So, Doc, when you say that, okay, go ahead.
Let me just get everybody cut up, Mike. We might have new people tuning in to our new hour at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You're listening to the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com radio show with your host, Michael Robinson, Ricky Hampton. And we're joined by Dr. Robert Turner, the author of Not For Long, The Life and Career of the NFL Athlete. I'm sorry, Mike, go ahead now.
So, Doc, so when you when you put this together, the documentary and the book, how much of that do you draw back from your career? And then what could you explain to us about your career? What was it like in college, and what was it like when you played at the pro level?
Well, both pieces, you know, they draw heavily on my own personal experiences. But I will say this, the book and the film project are two totally different projects, although I have the great fortune of them both coming out basically at the same time. The book focuses on NFL athletes and their transition to life after football. But as you know about the movie Student Athlete, it really talks about what is it like when athletes enter into that institution, and what is it like when they're in, as well as the difficult struggles that they might have when they transition out. So the books, you could actually say they're very much complementary to one another. They draw a lot from my own personal experiences. As I mentioned at the top of the hour, for me personally, I went to James Madison University in Harrisonburg, Virginia. I played for Coach Challis Joe McMillan. And when they recruited me, they had just started their program in Division I AA. And I was not that heavily recruited, but although I did have a scholarship to play football at Penn State, which is really, really, really where I wanted to go as a young man. But I chose to go to James Madison primarily for one reason, and that is because they were the first to offer me the scholarship. But Coach Joe Carrico, when he came to my living room and talked to me and my parents and sat us down, he said, listen, there are other colleges out there. I just came back. He had just come back from the National Coaches Convention, and he says your name there's a buzz around your name as a recruit, because I was being recruited late. And he said there's a lot of schools out here who want you, and believe me, they're going to come after you. He said, but at James Madison, we need you. And that was music to my ears as a 17-year-old kid. That kind of affirmation, that's really what I wanted. And it wound up being a great decision. For one, myself, I went to college with a bunch of guys in the Washington Redskins era. You remember Gary Clark, who won a bunch of Super Bowls. I went to school and played alongside of Charles Haley, who's in the Hall of Fame.
Okay.
We had just a number. We had 7-8 guys that wound up going to the pros. But what was so great about my personal experience was our coach, he didn't just give lip service to making sure that we got our education. He actually, can you imagine this? He was a Division I coach who actually ran the study hall program for us, and all freshmen were required to take study hall. And just that's a testament of what he believed education could do for you. And then once he finished being a coach, Coach McMillan went out and received his PhD. So I think that those seeds were probably planted very early in me, along with my family. But I also knew that when I got out, and I had a really difficult time in my transition, even with all of the assets, the family and everything behind me, I struggled. And so it made me think, well, what about some of the other players that I played with alongside who were great guys, but they were having struggles even during the off season? I wondered what their lives were going to be like. And that's what was the impetus for writing the book.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah, that's good stuff. Yeah. Hey guys, can you imagine Nick Saban running his study hall at Alabama?
Well, you know, Ricky.
Yeah.
Ricky, let me follow up on that. So
sure.
When you see all you wanted to go to Penn State. So you see all the fallout that happened years later with Joe Paterno and that whole institution. What was that like looking at that, saying that, man, I was almost an alum at this school?
Well, you know, it's really difficult for me to even be able to look at that somewhat objectively, because as I'm taught as a social scientist, you have to have all the facts, right? And so it would be easy for me to jump in and say what did or didn't happen. But I do know this. I know a lot of guys that I have been friends with over the years, even guys from my own high school that went to Penn State, and they won national championships with them. They call him Joe Pa. You saw that Franco Harris stood steadfast in his belief and his defense of Coach Paterno. So, you know, as a former ball player and someone who knows so many athletes who played there, it's very difficult for me to look at this somewhat objectively. But I can say from this standpoint, I can understand exactly how this situation could have happened. I can understand how Coach Paterno could have had a blind eye. I can understand how so many of the upper-level administrators in the program had blind eyes. I do definitely ultimately believe that it was Coach Paterno's responsibility, because it was his program and he was given so much power. But I believe that we need to see that very much so as a cautionary tale, because this is what happens when power is kind of acquiesced, so concentrated in one area, and that the only thing that becomes important is winning, then we become deaf, dumb, and blind to so many other injustices that happen.
All right.
Yeah, and on the collegiate level, staying on the collegiate level, you know, my 33-year career covering sports, talking to coaches, hey, man, their thought is, okay, if you get a degree out of this, that's fine. But your primary goal for me is to help me win football teams, because my family has to eat. And if you aren't helping me towards that end, I'm going to find somebody else. And that puts a lot of pressure, Dr. Turner, on some of these kids at the collegiate level to do whatever they have to do to perform, and all along with that goal of reaching the NFL or the NBA or whatever it might be in mind. And I remember a stat from the movie, from the documentary, I believe it was 91,000 athletes were playing college basketball and football, and I think it was over a 2-year period. And out of that number, or it could have been just 1 year.
It was just
only
300
or so were drafted, and we're not even talking about those who made the team or didn't make the team.
Well, so let me pick up on that stat, because actually, what it is was over 91,000 that played basketball and football in the NCAA at any given season, but through the NBA and the NFL, only 303 athletes were drafted. So that's a really small number of people if you think about it. So I think there's a couple of things that you raise, and these are things that I really dealt with in the book at length. And one of them is and again, I hope people might be, if you're interested, you can pick the book up at Amazon, you know, you can Amazon Prime. It's also on Oxford University Press. You can find it there and a number of other different outlets. But in addition to that,
Dr. Turner, we'll have it up on the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com as well. So they'll be able to go
wonderful.
There and find it.
I appreciate that very much.
I
think one of the problems that we have today in particular is, and one of my central arguments that I believe as far as the NCAA is concerned, it's tied up into what I call the sports industrial complex. And today, unlike, you know, even a generation ago, where today you have little kids who are pitchers in junior high school that are getting Tommy John surgeries in their arms because of overuse, right? And what you basically have is – you have just think about this for a second. In youth sports in particular, it's over a $15 billion industry, right? And the thing about it, it is very loosely regulated, if regulated at all. When there's that much money at stake, which, by the way, is just a tad bit more than the NFL generates on an annual basis, and youth sports is growing. So when you have it unregulated like that, you have a lot of demands, crazy demands put on kids. Kids normalize it as though this is the what I have to do. Families look at it, this is what it takes to get a scholarship. And then so this is kind of what I talk about the habitus in the book, is the mindset where it's almost a brainwashing of young people that by the time they enter into college on football and basketball, they're doing whatever they can to reach that brass ring. And what I argue in the book is that in football in particular, you have the whole thing is about competition. Where on every level, it's this ring where people are fighting to stay in what I call the sports tournament. So even though you're supposed to be brotherhood and playing alongside of each other, we all know this. When you get recruited, and let's say there are five receivers that are in your class every year, so that now you're looking at 20, you know, maybe somewhere is around 10 receivers, 15 receivers on the roster, only three, four of them are going to play. So they're all competing against each other. The coaches are competing against each other. The offensive coordinators across the country, because the higher you go up, the fewer slots they are. But here's the thing that I really focus on in the book, is that there are competing interests built in and designed into the institution. The only place throughout, I'm talking youth football, high school football, college football, NFL, the only place there isn't competition is in the owner's suite, because you got 32 owners who they share their money, they put it in a big old pot, and they share it. So every year, it doesn't matter who wins the Super Bowl, every owner shares the same amount of money, except for the Super Bowl winner gets about 20% more because of merchandise and a few other gaming rights. But other than that, every year, they're making all this money. And all along the way, junior high school kid is fighting to get on the varsity. The high school kid is fighting to get into college, and the college kid is fighting to get on an NFL roster.
We last week, and totally agree with you, Dr. Turner, but, man, there are guys who stand all that, and to hell with it. They're going for it, and you know, every now and then they break through. Last week on this show, we were joined by Robert Porche, former All-Pro defensive tackle for the Detroit Lions, and
right.
and Larry Tharp, who was a right tackle for the Detroit Lions. Both came out of HBCUs, South Carolina State and Tennessee State. Actually, Porche started at Tennessee State and finished up at South Carolina State. But they were long shots. And they just so happened to meet as freshmen and made this pact. We're going to make it to the NFL. And through it all, coming out of these small schools, they were able to do it and have good careers, 13 years and I believe 9 years. But even through all that they went through and some of the physical discomforts and problems they have now, you know, they'll do it all over again. I mean, and as Larry Tharp told me, he said, man, the ability for me to provide for my family was worth everything I went through and everything I'm dealing with now. So how do you tell a guy, like a kid like Shamar who sees that dream, how do you tell him, hey, man, well, something else too, or this isn't for you, unfortunately?
Well, I think there's a couple of things, again, trying to unpack that. First of all, just dealing with the second part of that question, and then we'll go back to the first part. But how do you tell a guy like Shamar? You said, how do you tell a kid like Shamar? Well, in the movie, we see that Shamar is 30, 31 years old. Shamar is no longer a kid.
Yeah, he's not even a kid, yeah.
That's right. And so one of the problems that we have because the way the system is kind of set up, and I can't blame the system per se, but it fosters, in one instance, a sense of entitlement. As through the movie, talks about in a lot of different ways, and I look about this in the book. But the other thing, there's a couple of other things that have there, is beyond the entitlement, it tells Shamar is really caught up in kind of what we believe in America about meritocracy, is if you work hard enough, right, and you put the time in, your talents will eventually shine through and you will obtain it. And one of the real problems that I found with doing 140 interviews with athletes is that we're not prepared, we don't have a narrative, we don't have a set of tools in our toolbox that if you commit yourself to this idea that if I work hard, I have the talent, that I'm going to succeed, we don't have the right language, we don't have the right way of thinking about, well, what happens if things don't work out? And this is where Shamar is kind of stuck. Is he's also in the industry of sports and this whole thing in football, it really for lots of guys, they get suspended in this kind of state of adolescence. They don't grow older, and I don't say this in a kind of a pejorative way. But when people are doing everything for you and enabling you, don't worry too much about your grades, because all you need to do is stay eligible. We'll steer you towards the right classes to get you eligible. You'll get a degree, but we don't have to worry about so much about how much you actually learned and how much you learned how to think, because you can run faster than other people, you can catch better than other people, and you can shoot jumpers into everybody. You do that stuff and we'll figure out all the rest of the stuff for you. Well, what happens when the ball no longer has any air in it? And everybody else has been doing things for you all this time. Now you've all of a sudden have to function in an adult world without the skill development that you need outside of the field. So that's one thing. Now let's go back to the question that you asked before. These gentlemen who would do it all over again. Well, one of the things we have to recognize is that there, for black men in particular, the one thing sports does is it does often provide you, if you make it, it provides you with a great opportunity to be financially set. But what it also does, as a good sociologist, I'm supposed to emphasize, but what it also does is it makes you, as a black man, it gives you social status and it makes you socially relevant. And we know that black men in America today, this is in part what the whole take a knee thing is all about, is black men are fighting constantly in and out of sports for respect. Yeah. And so let's just put it this way. When you have black young men who are working hard at their craft and they make it all the way to the pinnacle of success, by every definition, they are truly successful. And then the president of the United States calls them SOBs and says, throw them out of the country. This is in part where black men are continuing to struggle. And so if you have difficulties on that level, think about all the other men who haven't made it to that far. So this is part of why sports has been so important to our communities, but it's also why, in some respects, we have to recognize that we're still in America and we're dealing with these structures that don't necessarily they weren't designed for our success.
So, Doc, I was going to come to you with that too. So I was going to come to you about not for long, and it's usually by injury, attrition, lack of performance. But when you get someone who has a not for long career because of them protesting, and going back to when you were talking about Dr. Harry Edwards, so him protesting is the reason why he's out of the NFL. So what is your real opinion on that, that this man, better than probably half the quarterbacks in the league right now, is sitting on the sideline because of this, and it's basically they're whiteballing him, per se, because of him trying to stand up for, like we said, people of color that aren't at the level he is, maybe economically?
Well, I think this. I think, that's a debate that we like to have in the media, we like to have in the barbershop, we like to have, in the public. But I think, if we were taking Dr. Harry Edwards' approach to this and looking at what Kaepernick is doing with his life, it seems to me that Kaepernick, the reason he took the stand in the first place is because he saw that there was much more to life that was much more important than just football or just sports. Mm. It was a platform. And what he has done, what I believe, I've never met the brother before, but what I believe he has done, what I see him doing, is saying, you know what? I have moved beyond football. There is a greater cause. There are more fights out there. I've committed myself. Ultimately, I knew that if I did this, it may cost me in this one arena. But you know what? It was worth it because now I'm free to pursue the things that I know really need to be looked after. He understood one thing, and that's for sure, that no matter whether he took that knee then or he waited 5 years later or whatever, there was a shelf life to who he is as an athlete. But in terms of being a humanitarian, in terms of him being fighting for justice and fighting for causes that he believes in, he really has committed his life to that. And what I would think, for me personally, I think he is a beacon of light, just as LeBron is a beacon of light, and they are showing us a way of advocacy and a way of athletics that we haven't had, you know, since the 60s, and I'm really thankful that they're willing to do this because, let's be honest, if I play wide receiver in the NFL or if I don't, it's not going to affect the world that greatly. But Kaepernick has found a way to make a great contribution.
And he will be remembered far beyond what he did on the football field. His contribution to society history is going to remember him well. And Abdul Raouf, who's a friend of our show, the courage he had, you know, 25 years ago, to stand up for what he believed in, cost him his career in the National Basketball Association. But you look at Abdul today, and he's an advocate for social justice, and he's out there working, and he's going to be remembered very kindly in history too. And the thing with Abdul is, every summer he gets to show us that he could still shoot that thing a little bit too,
Yes, he can. Yes, he. But see, gentlemen like this, I hope that, you know, let us as a society and let us as a community recognize that they are making contributions and they can teach us ways. And they are controlling a particular or attempting to control a narrative in a way that we can teach those those lessons to the younger generations coming behind them and saying to them, you know, we value you on and off the court. We want you to stand up and put your energy towards the things that you believe in. And I think that will help. We will be proud as a community when more young men have that personal conviction to do that. Now, let's be honest also. We have to understand that not everybody could have done what Kaepernick has done, and certainly not everybody can do what LeBron does because of their financial situations and all those other things. But if we can at least get people to recognize that you, again, this system that we're talking about on the college level and on the professional level, and in some instances, all the way drilling down to youth sports. This is part of American capitalism at its best, right? And this is all about the cultural consumption. And so these machines need laborers, right? And to the extent that they can pay, they can get labor for free, or they can pay it for a little to nothing. We are in a system where there's people who control the levers and are really we get caught up into that. So we have to recognize and, I think, teach our young folks, and we have to maybe place the emphasis in other places other than just how many baskets you made and how many touchdowns you made on the weekend.
All right. You're listening to the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com radio show with your hosts Michael Robinson and Ricky Hampton. And we're joined by Dr. Robert Turner, the author of Not For Long, The Life and Career of the NFL Athlete. Dr. Turner, I don't know how much more time you got, but I'd love it if you stay a few minutes. We're going to bring on a gentleman now that I think you'd be interested to hear the work that he's doing and maybe take part in the conversation with this gentleman we're about to bring on. His name is Robert T. Green, and he's the CEO.
Sure, I'll
of
be very happy to
Game.
Stay on.
Okay, well, I'm gonna leave you on the air, and we're gonna go to our guest line and bring in a great friend of the show, and one of the sharpest brothers out here working on behalf of athletes, young and old, high school through pros, Robert T. Green, the CEO of Pre-Post Game, Inc. Hey, Rob, you're on with Ricky Hampton, Michael Robinson, and a gentleman, I don't know if you've met him, Dr. Robert Turner, the author of NFL, Not For Long, The Life and Career of the NFL Athlete. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Absolutely. I appreciate it, gentlemen. How are you guys doing tonight?
All right.
Hey, man, we're doing great. We've been having this great conversation with Dr. Turner about the role of the athlete, in particular the black athlete, but it pertains to all athletes. And we know that you're on top of a lot of issues that are going on in the world of sports today. One of the things I wanted to get you on to talk about was the NCAA's new rule on transfers. And before we get in that, explain to our listening audience the work you guys are doing at Pre-Post Game.
Okay, well, obviously, like I said, thank you guys for having me on. I'm the CEO of a company called Pre-Post Game. We're a sports business management, transition, succession, and advisory firm for athletes at every level. One of our main mantras is say sports is not a game, sports is all business. And most athletes, that when you start to play a sport, a lot of the times they have a ball and a bat in their hand before they can even speak English. And because of that, you know, the institutionalization of their thought process in their mind is now directed based off of, you know, a lot of times the economic or social standing. So for us, it's about helping them understand. We talk about, as me being personally known as a player's rep, here to educate, empower, protect the athletes and the family's best interests alone. So teaching them the system of the game and how to use the game as it tried to use you, understanding it in my mantra and what we talk about, the golden rule in pertaining to sports, is that those that have the goal make the rules, but the goal is the players. But they're the least ones that know what really goes into it. So everything that we do is basically from educational standpoint. We don't like to kill dreams. We like to promote dreams, but we like to, you know, build the actual business through the dream. So, for example, there's no such thing as an overnight millionaire, a successful overnight millionaire. So when we talk to athletes at the young age, we'll say, well, what do you want to do? I want to secure the bag. Well, you can't secure the bag if you don't know how to maintain and sustain it, because in this country, it costs money to stay rich. So those are the last things they figure out after the fact, and at least the amount that they know, that literally there's a group of people at every level, high school, college, pro, and in the youth, they're sitting there waiting to say, well, they don't know anything. Focus on the game. Trust the process, which we know that's a complete fallacy. So those are some of the things that we do as an overview, but essentially saying that we can walk into bubblegum and also be successful on and off the field, court, ring, or whatever else it may be.
And Rob, what is going on with the NCAA and its new rules regarding transfer?
Okay, so from a Division I standpoint, we'll cover that really quick. The Power Five today, October 15th, was the beginning of the actual NCAA transfer rule, where once before, the athlete had to go and try to, they wanted to leave school, they had to get what you call permission to contact slip from the school in order to transfer somewhere else. And for the most part, a lot of coaches in schools would basically block that athlete. At one point when I was playing in sports, a lot of times the coaches will find out that you want to leave, and they'll call their buddies up, and they'll basically blackball you, if you will, being able to leave. They'll put certain narratives out there that literally didn't allow the kid to transfer properly and have the opportunity to really go do what they want to do. In particular football, there's 700 schools you can play football at, and based off these stars and that you get, 3-star, 4-star, 5-star, even when they talk about the APR now, which is the annual progress rate, based off of your actual academic grades, even though you might be in a class that literally allows you to fall asleep and your assignment is to write about your dream when you wake up, and they still give you a 3.0 at Power 5 schools, that literally these guys now say, you know what, you told me everything I wanted to hear, not what I needed to know. So the NCAA, for the first time since 1906 when this entity began, this is the most progressive and basically realistic actual opportunity for athletes to be empowered to make the decisions on their own. So now instead of, you don't have to actually go to the coach anymore. So athlete simply has to go to the actual compliance office and fill out their intent to transfer paperwork. And when they do that, within 48 business hours, that school would place the athlete's name into a database where the coach is like, if you will, a fantasy roster, or, again, and they don't want to call it free agency, but that's exactly what it is.
Huh.
They'll be able to look at it and then basically see or get be able to contact you and a parent and basically open up your recruitment process again. What happened is that the school can say you're a three-star or a guy that's not making the roster and wants to leave. You can literally have your financial aid through your scholarship, cut after the end of that semester. So timing is everything regarding that. You know, when we advise and consult people regarding that, they got to understand, even though the rule has changed, that the coach and the university is still going to play a game to a certain extent. So if you do it too late, you do it too early, you don't have an idea, a plan to make a move, then you can get yourself set up for the same situation twice. So, but like literally, they put your name in a database. You can be contacted from there. And then when that semester's over, the school can either say, you know what, are you leaving, are you staying? They can say you can keep your scholarship or they can take it away from you. So, but at the same time, it gives the athlete and the parent opportunity to understand that even though you got me here now, I'm going to leave. And now it's a scenario where coaches aren't allowed to block players left and right. What I like to say all the time is that sports is about two things at every level. That's selling tickets and recruiting. And when it starts to come out that some of these coaches have misled or set up kids for failure to a certain extent, me personally, not company personally, will continue to make a database full of that. So now you can ask the pertinent questions like, why did this kid leave and why did that kid leave? And basically now the parents and the other athletes start communicating to each other to make a better business decision for themselves. So that's happening now, and since the first, it's like the second day. In 2 days, it's been over 200 transfers already, and I expect to be a lot more. Particularly, I mentioned there's going to be a mass exodus from two Power 5 schools. Again, I'm not at liberty to say which two yet, but it's coming soon. And based off of that situation from there, you'll find that some of these schools and how they operate with some of these coaches are going to have to change up their tune. For example, if you look at just Scott Frost last year being, 13-0 at Central Florida, and now at Nebraska, he's 0-6, the worst record, star record in the history of that program. And once again, I always say about the player. And then if you go back to Chip Kelly, who's won his first game at UCLA, 1-5. So at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter who the coach is when it comes to winning or losing in the sport. It's about the actual players that you were able to convince to go to that school. Now, if you convince them to go to that school and then everything you said is a lie and it set them up for failure, you're going to end up being 0-6. You're going to end up being 1-5. And as you see, when Scott Frost and his entire staff left, isn't Central Florida still undefeated? They're on a 19-game winning streak or something like that? So, like I said, again, those are the realities of the business that we're in, even including Urban Meyer, even though Ohio State's undefeated, they started off 3-0. So, once again, what families and athletes are starting to understand is that they're the ones that drive the ship in the boat. And so this is the NCAA way of trying to give an inch, even though they got a lot further to go, regarding understanding the athletes are the ones that drive this boat.
But I'm going to throw this out to you, Rob, and then I'd like to get Dr. Turner to step in on this. How many kids do you think know this? And let's be honest, we got kids who are coming into the college level who are strictly there to play whatever sport it might be and have no idea about the business side of it.
Zero. And that's why my company is called Pre-Post Game, before, during, and after. When it was formulated, it was based off the idea and thought process of what an athlete usually buys into. And if anybody that plays sports, we can all tell you that we all had the same pregame routine. And if it was altered in any way, usually it didn't end up the way we want. And then you talk about the postgame and what the responsibilities after the fact, you know, whether you win or lose, how you conduct yourself, how you move on from there. And so the fact is why specifically I do, you know, a lot of the podcasts that we do now, you know, the worldwide leader, the ESPN, they're not covering this situation that's, you know, basically it's monumental. Since 1906, this is the first real legislation created that actually gives the athlete and the family an opportunity to do something. I mean, even then, they didn't come back and ask the athletes and families, what can we do to help to make your situation better in this actual situation? I mean, they covered Nick Bosa today withdrawing from school, you know, saying that I'm going to go to the league right now because I'm not coming back to play, which, again, it falls along the lines of everything during this transfer process. Like, the bottom line, that whole hashtag free education mantra, like, no, it's not free and it's not really educational. Again, when a kid, whether he's Caucasian or African-American, decides to leave and say, hey, the smart guy says, I got $30 million on the table right now. You want me to sit here and sacrifice that for a hat and a T-shirt? Like, okay.
There you go.
Where?
Dr. Turner, when you were playing ball, obviously academics was important to you. Did you walk on campus with that mindset as being a true student athlete? Was it somebody that inspired you to look at the academic part? And what are your thoughts on some of the things that Rob talked about?
Well, I'll say real quickly about my situation. I came from, for me, when I was young, my whole mindset is I really wanted to play in the NFL. But education was real important to me because I was told at a very young age, and my parents kind of enforced this at the house, is if you don't have the grades, you don't play. Right. So when I was playing in Pop Warner football, my mom reminded me that there was at one point in time I didn't have, you know, I failed a test or something like that. And I was like the star of my little Pop Warner team. And they said, no, you can't play. And the coaches and everybody was begging, please let him play. Please let him play. She said, no. And when she turned around and said to me, she said, there's basically, you know what? There's a cost to your actions. And so if you want to play, you do the right thing. And so I'm very glad that she did that. And, again, I think the best thing that ever happened to me was it was so fortuitous that I just chose to go to a school where he said, you're going to get an education, and he meant it, the head coach. So I was very – some of these things was based on my own purposeful mindfulness, but others were I was just lucky that I chose the right place to go. But going back to what Rob has said here – I will say this, I really agree with so many of the things that he has said, and you asked the question, how many parents know? And I will tell you, I have a nephew who's a freshman right now at the University of Nevada, Reno, and he was faced with this same exact situation, playing a little bit in the first few games, and then his dad was trying to figure out, should we in turn do the red shirt right now? And the coaches, you know, said, hey, no, we're going to play you a lot. And so, you know, the problem that you have is that these are really good salesmen, these coaches. I mean, just as he has said, listen, the bottom line, the coach is getting paid a couple $1 million to win, and he needs bodies out there. So he may be deceiving you on purpose, or he may be telling you what you need to know or what he wants you to hear, but ultimately he's trying to win. So, when you have these competing interests, it makes it really difficult, and I will say wholeheartedly, most, like he said, zero parents really understand. I have had a number of calls, people calling me since the movie, and, you know, student-athlete, and saying, what do we do? Because my son's playing right now, and I don't know how to help him. And so there's a big void, a big need, and I do think that the NCAA is going to pull another one and ultimately try to close this up as a loophole ultimately, because it does give so much power to the athletes. But the power is still not in the hands of the athletes when they and their parents are ignorant of the facts that they need to better make decisions in the system.
Well, speaking of Dr. Turner, that's a great point. And really quick, Ricky, what he says, system. And what I speak about all the time regarding sports in this country, and people don't really understand the economic standings, how sports really generate revenue. I talk about, you know, Google from the information center when you want to learn something. I talk about Amazon now these days when they, like, basically put, you know, Toys R Us and a couple of people out of business in that scenario. You also talk about the phones and how it became a trillionaire business because everything goes through those actual formulation systems. But in the sports world, everything since the beginning has been he say, she say, and that is so dangerous, especially with so much money involved now, because most athletes and families make decisions based off of terms like trust the process and God's plan. As you know,
exactly.
I have an actual database system that I created that literally puts every – actually, we call what the ultimate sports dictionary. For example, things such as runner versus the mentor, or financial, or CPA, certified public accountant. Everything that you want to become as an athlete at every level, we teach you from the ground up. So now when you start to ask questions, the parents ask questions, you now have a database and a system in the palm of your hand or an app to actually rebut what they're saying. So if a coach was to lie to you right directly to your face, you actually look at it and say, no, that's not true. So now that's empowering the actual family and athletes to understand what's what. And that's what's needed, because at the end of the day, they are exactly salesmen. And the reason why as all these things that continue to happen, people don't realize the coaches are the ones that are getting paid to keep the athletes and the parents right where they are at every level. And that's why when it comes to any type of situation that the athletes actually have to go through and change, the coaches are silent on it, whether it's pay the players, whether it's the situation with the abuse or the bullying, what anything it may be. And then they'll say team, 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 but the moment that player on that team gets hurt, it's next man up. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. So, again, at the end of the day, when it comes down to it, if those exact players that are the athletes that are talented, the ones that decide to take their talents elsewhere or leave school early, then once again, then those players are going to be out of a job. But again, I always tell parents from day one, when you're, again, speaking of your situation, Dr. Turner, never allow it to happen from day one. As soon as you signed your NLI, which is completely against what the players need to do, but how that system
right.
works is that they basically say, okay, let ESPN put you on a TV show for 10 minutes and give you three hats and pull the hat out. So now you're giving free marketing and advertising to three schools, and yet you realize, don't realize, once you sign that letter, you now allow them to stop even talking about you. But if your goal is to make it to the league, you got to understand the business side of the PR, public relations side, is very, very a big component in this. And so now you're going to allow a school to say, well, I don't got to spend another dollar to come see you, visit you, talk to you, nothing. But yet if you want to talk to somebody else because I left to take a job somewhere else, you're stuck. Why would you sign that?
So,
well, you didn't even ask them any questions. You spent 3 years of recruiting and then giving you pictures and gloves and then turn around within 30 seconds and put a document in front of you and tell you to sign. Your pride is in a way that you don't want to say that I don't know what it says and what it is. Because you want to feel like that you've got it under control. That's the catch. They treat you like a king and a queen through that process, because you would never believe that would happen to you, because they wouldn't do that to me because I'm so special. And you sign, and then you're in the same boat as everybody else. So the fact of the matter is,
let's get Mike in on this conversation. Mike.
Well, I want to go back to the academic part of it. So Doc, when you had that moment where you failed that test and your mother said, no, you can't play, so you saw the drawback of that. So did during that process going forward, did you compete in the classroom as well as you did on the field, and did you ever think that you'd go from that moment to a PhD?
Well, that's an easy question to answer. Is the answer to all of that is no. Because I will say, for me, again, sometimes God has divine intervention, and you know, sometimes you're lucky by what you don't know. So when I was a kid, I was a first-generation college student, so I didn't know anything about getting into college. I had no idea. I just remember at my school when I was a kid in high school, they had what was called a college prep track, right? And then, of course, they had the, people who were doing the AP track and stuff like that, which I didn't do. So I knew that what they said in order to graduate with a college, the regular minimum standards in my high school, in my town at that time, is I think everybody had to take 2 years of English, 2 years of math, 2 years of, history, stuff like that. So without, any real guidance from my guidance counselors or my parents, I just figured, well, the best way to give myself the best opportunity to go to college, since that's what you have to do to play pro, then I might as well take 4 years. If they were saying you had to take a minimum of two, I might as well double my chances and take four. So that was just my logic as a kid, but it helped me really, really well to be prepared for college. But then, and I write about some of this stuff in the book, but when I went to college, I didn't know how to pick a major. I didn't know what majors were available, and I picked my major as communication like so many other athletes, because several other guys in the locker room were doing communication, and I thought, well, that's good. I'll just do that. Now, did I know what communications was going to do for me when I got done or anything else like that? No. So I didn't really have a great academic plan, but I guess through, God's intervention, I was smart enough and I had performed well enough that years later, when I turned 40 years old, I went to go get a PhD, and I was prepared enough and I did well enough on the exams and they let me in, and that put me on the trajectory that I am right now. But I would tell lots of young people, you probably don't want to do it the way I did it, because there's a lot of resources around, like Rob is just talking about right now. There's too many of us now who can help young people go down the right path, whereas back when I was playing, we were on an island. I had no idea.
Yeah, okay. And that's why I think what the work Rob does at pre-post game is so important, and you know, because there's so many kids out there who just don't know, so many parents of kids. I remember, and we talked about it on the show, Rob, you know, LeBron James, and this guy is a shark. LeBron James is the template for the 21st century athlete in terms of how he's controlled his career and looked beyond the sport of basketball and used his position as a social platform to make a difference. But even LeBron did not know when they talked about the possibility of recruiting his kid.
Right.
Even LeBron didn't know all the rules and regulations that his son had to deal
real
with.
Real quick on that,
yeah.
There's a new thing called the APR, and this wasn't around when Dr. Turner and even I, when I played. So the APR is annual percentage progress rate. And what that means is when he talked about he picked the communications major at the Power 5 conferences, now you don't get to pick majors. As a matter of fact, if you want to go to a certain class past 1 o'clock, it's not going to happen. So you can want to be an engineer. You can want to be a doctor. So when I tell parents, we advise them before they're making college decisions, that you can go online and look at some of the actual programs that they have in place prior to that to see if you actually can take it. But you'll find that regardless of the fact once you go there with a certain plan, they'll have the, what you call, quote-unquote, academic athletic advisor. He'll put you in certain classes. And because when you get that grade point average and you think it's about, oh, I got a 3.0, no one really looks at what classes that they took. But the thing is, that rewards coaches with $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 bonuses just to have these classes. So the NCAA can print out a receipt and say these kids are doing great and this and that situation. So in particular, football is 100 guys on most rosters, but the fact is only 44 to 55 really ever play. So the guys that are really getting 3.7 and getting the degrees are what they call the preferred walk-ons who don't really go to class.
Yeah.
They don't make it to practice every day. Nobody knows or cares. They barely play. And they'll get a 3.9, 4.0, and they'll end up saying they get all Big Ten and this, this, and that. So for me, again, and what goes on now, there's so many athletes that even if they do finish up school, and it's never for the guys that are highly rated guys, the system is set up even now, this upcoming 2019 NFL draft. The top 13 players are underclassmen because the NFL wants cheap labor. They don't want your best year to be played in college, but the college don't want you to get out. The college wants you to stay. There's a lot of things that go into business mentally that they actually twist and turn and how they help promote you and not promote you, even speaking about the whole red shirt scenario and knowing how that changed. So, again, to keep you from not leaving, and they'll say certain things to you, say, oh, yeah, we're going to play next week, knowing that you passed a certain window in the time that you decide to leave. Now you got no choice but to stay. And so it's like, is this way over the top for most people? And specifically, speaking of the SEC, where unfortunately a lot of the parents or first-generation athletes come from families that have second- and third-grade education, is the biggest meal ticket ever for that actual conference, because at the end of the day, they don't have to say nothing but, oh, you're going to get a free scholarship. Don't know what that means, don't know what that consists of, and there's nothing free about it. And then you have guys, if you really look at, yeah, you talk about Alabama and national championships. Well, if you talk about going to the pros, how many guys have had so many significant issues off the field, not just from a football standpoint, but their careers are burnt out because they spent a lot of time making sure Nick Saban got a ring and a hat, and their bodies are beat down. Whether it's Trent Richardson, the third pick overall in the 2012 draft, he's already out the NFL. Derrick Henry ain't doing too much better as of right now. Mark Ingram right now, who's, you know, and his contract is coming off a suspension of 4 games for PEDs. So as much as they talk about how, and then it's a quarterback-driven league, and you can't even find a quarterback Nick Saban ever placed in the NFL. So you talk about Tua and Jalen Hurts right now, it's like they're making all the big fuss. Like, have you been paying attention to the actual history of the business you want to be in? Most of them haven't until it's too late. Because those that
Dr. Turner.
Yes. Yes.
Shamar is a graduate of Rutgers, correct?
That is correct. He graduated with, it was journalism, communication and journalism at Rutgers. That's right.
For our listening on, Shamar Graves was one of the featured individuals in the documentary Student Athlete who was working with Dr. Turner. I mean, well, at least he got his degree from Rutgers.
Well, so I'm going to try to because we could have these conversations all night long because we're like in a zone. We're talking to each other, and this is great, right? But I want to back this out a little bit so I can make sure that we bring this to the level of the audience, because there's a couple of things here that we know because we've been studying and listening about all this, but it's really important to understand this in a certain way. And Shamar's mom, I was at a film festival, and I was with her while she watched the movie. And I asked her, what did she think about the movie? And she said, it was really hard to watch. I wanted to cry the whole time. I would have gotten up and walked out of it because it was so difficult. And I asked her, in what respect? And she said, well, I didn't know that Shamar was struggling so hard. That was number one. And she goes, and I didn't know he was in so much pain. But she says, you know, I wish now, because Shamar finished in 2010, I think, or something. She says, I didn't even understand anything about football, and I didn't want him to go to Rutgers, but he wanted to go because he thought I was going to take care of us, and the coaches made all of these promises. She said, but I feel so bad for everything that I didn't know. And that's kind of what Rob is talking about right now.
Yeah.
But I also want to bring it down to this other level, because I have seen this. I was just on a panel last week in New York City with Chris Borland, who was the athlete the third-round draft choice for the 49ers and quit after 1 year because of concussions. But what he said was, and I think this is very profound, he said lots of athletes, and this is what Rob was talking about, Bob, and their families, they get caught in the ether of the bright lights of what the sports is all about, right? And so there are, like, I saw a situation where I advised a parent, I said, listen, before your son signs, and, you know, you don't have to actually sign the letter of intent. It's not even an NCAA letter. You don't have to sign it, right? And I told him about this. And then I said, but before you sign, I said, well, you have the most power and the most agency is before you sign. So when you go to the coach's office, you ask the coach, don't tell me about GPAs, don't tell me about graduation rates, but tell me, first of all, I said to him, I said, ask the coach, you've coached that before. I would like a list of 2, 3, 4 players who've played for you at different schools, and I want to talk to them about their experience playing for you. I want to know what majors they had, and give me, because you're going to sell me any way you want to, but I want to know who's been through this program. But then I also want to know, even if he just got there, let me know over the last 5 years, what are the concentration of majors for your football program? Right? Because that'll give me a better real indication of how important education is at your school. But then I also said to him, I said, okay, when you talk to this coach, you know, ask them about what are the rules, how do you deal with education on your football program? And let me talk to a couple kids who are in there right now or who just recently graduated. And, you know, when I gave this, these parents had said, this is a great idea. Yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that. And you know what? When it came time to make a decision, they didn't do any of it. Why? Because they were afraid that if they asked these kinds of questions, that the coach would say, well, we don't want to offer you a scholarship anymore. And so, therefore, they remained ignorant on purpose just for the opportunity to play in the bright light. And that's really dangerous, and it's very sad in my
estimation. Because they don't know their worth, and that's the point. And they don't realize without the actual athlete, there's no college programs, there's no nothing. No coaching profession without players. So you're absolutely right. You got to learn how to audit. You got to learn how to monitor. You got to learn how to vet the people and conduct the interview process. It's both ways. It's a two-way street, and that's the point. And even to add to your point about the actual national letter of intent and the scholarship, before you sign anything, you can actually say, you know what, if you leave, I want to transfer. This whole letters of intent and other things that they put in place that you sign, like usually the intellectual property piece is signed after you get in, so players don't even know what that means, the IP.
That's right.
But anyway,
that's
when you
right.
give your likeness and image away. But before that, you can say, okay, well, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that. And if you want me to come here, I'm a 6'3", 230-pound wide receiver on a 4.3, and I know my worth right now. And if you leave, coach, after I come here, then I want to be able to transfer with no restrictions. You can have your lawyer write that up the same exact way they write theirs, right theirs up to you. And you sign.
And I've seen it. I have seen it. So you're right on time. I've seen it in football, and I've seen it outside of football and other things. So it's there.
Right. But parents don't know that. So it's a two-way – it's a business decision. So if you want me that much, then be willing to put what you say in writing. So there's no discrepancy. No more he say, she say, your word versus mine. Can't afford to do that these days.
There's some university out there with 5 years. Let me just get everybody caught up. We only got a few more minutes left here on the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com with Michael Robinson and Ricky Hampton. We're joined by Dr. Robert Turner, the author of Not For Long, The Life and Career of the NFL Athlete, and our good friend Robert T. Green, CEO of Pre-Post-Game Incorporated. Rob, I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
No problem. No, I said that it's a two-way street, but usually, like Dr. Turner said, that a lot of times parents feel like that they're the reason why the coaches are offering them a scholarship because they're doing them a favor. No, these actual kids are the reason why these universities can make all the money that they make. But again, a lot of times this thing, which I tabbed, as you know, called sports trafficking, goes from top to bottom. And so when you get, like, bonuses from, like, say, schools like Alabama, you know how I feel about that scenario, if he kicks some of that money back down to the youth program or to the local high school, then they dragging him up there for an unofficial visit. They don't realize how a guy, for example, like a Julio Jones or Amari Cooper out of Florida ended up in Alabama. Nick will never get his hands dirty regarding some of those things, but how it happens, we know exactly how it happens. And that's why, again, a lot of parents now turn around and the people that's really sitting there saying that they advise them got their best interests in mind, getting their pockets greased left and right and thinking that they're making their own decisions, and they're not. That's how deep it is now when it comes to sports in this country. And again, the last people to figure that out is the actual athlete and the actual parent.
The last one.
All right, so I have a question. Okay, I have a question for both you guys. Okay, so my alma mater, Tennessee State University, and Ricky knows that too because he covered them, but we had a player that got injured in a big game against Vanderbilt, and he was taken to the Vanderbilt Hospital, and he's still hospitalized now with a head injury. So when you guys look at something like that, they haven't even made it to that pro level yet, and to have a catastrophic injury like this right now, what from your end, Rob, what happens? What's his or parents' scenario, what they can do to make sure that he's taken care of, even if it's lifelong? And then for you, Doc, from your perspective, intellectually, what's the deal with when a situation like that happens?
Well, from my perspective, from the athlete standpoint, obviously when it comes to the medical care that he will receive while he's under scholarship, until he's out the hospital, he'll get whatever he needs. Now, when you talk about from a long-term diagnosis, you'll mm-hmm. barely get anything, to be honest with you. There's several players that have been in a situation, they got hurt from a long-term injury, and once the initial care is treated, you know, a lot of times they say you can't play anymore. You will hope some schools may allow the athlete to finish their actual scholarship, but even then, some schools, it's not even a guarantee. I like to think of Eric LeGrand out of Rutgers and his situation, how he's kind of became an ambassador. He's also a player that got hurt significantly, ended up being put in a chair and things of that nature. But even now, when he's in that chair and still doing, if you want to call it, ambassador for Rutgers, most of that stuff that he has to do from insurance-wise comes from his mother, but nobody ever talks about that. Regarding Power mm-hmm. 5 athletes in general, what we advise, again, a lot of schools don't want people to know that, but through the Student Athletic Fund, if you are an actual athlete that has a pro potential, once you get to a certain level that you know that you may be a significant high draft pick, Lloyds of London will provide what they call loss of value and PTD, permanent disability insurance, to cover you for situations such as the young man in Tennessee State. But when you talk about HBCU, most of those guys aren't afforded that type of actual medical care or coverage.
Okay. So I'll jump in. There's a couple thoughts that I have on the situation, and one is that I think, you know, this is one of the reasons, the main fight that the NCAA has and their main interest in this moniker of student athlete and not employees is because they don't want to pay workers' compensation, right?
Right.
That is the whole thing. People, you know, that never becomes part of the conversation, but that's the holy grail. That's the golden goose. That's everything. Even when Stanford said, you know, this unionization goes through with private schools where the athletes can unionize, they said we'd have to rethink our commitment to sports, not just football, to all sports. And everyone likes to try to think, well, this is because you have to pay them a salary or because you have to have the same budgets for Title IX. It's none of that. It is, in fact, if I if I'm an employee and I may have hurt my back at 18 to 20 years old, but then I want to file a workers' compensation claim at 40 because of the injury that I had while I was working for you, that's what they're really afraid of. And so to me, I think where we are today on a situation like this is I'm finding through this movie, Student Athlete, you know, that was on HBO documentary, you can find it now on HBO Sports, and through the book, my phone has started to ring a lot. The emails have started to come in. I think we might be at a unique point in time where people have said, you know, you don't have to convince me any longer that these athletes are being exploited and they got a bad deal. People kind of have already, you know, 10 years ago, people didn't buy that. I think people are starting to see that that's the case. But what people are asking now is, what can we do? What has to be done to change this situation? I am a social scientist. I'm a sociologist as well as have a degree in I'm studying neuroscience. I'm looking. My work is all about helping athletes that may have cognitive deficiencies. I'm learning how and focusing on how the brain ages with injury, and so how we might be able to protect athletes that have played these games and have had traumatic brain injury. So I say that to say I'm very vested in the life and the health and the career of athletes, but I you know, I'm working in the lab so much of what I do. I think we need people like Robert there who really understand what's going on. We need them to be educating the families. We need them to be on the charge of trying to maybe make this social movement to the fact that I do think the real pressure point possibly is the kids who haven't entered into the NCAA yet. Because as he said, you need those laborers. If we start to really get parents and saying, you know, let's say in the state of Georgia where we know that they're harvesting lots of kids to go and play throughout the SEC, well, if we got certain communities and certain families and certain former players all coming together and saying, you're not treating this next generation the way you treated us, you will start to see some significant changes at that point.
Well, the biggest situation that almost happened, and again, to really change it, Missouri, when the young man was being picked on through the swastika and the feces, if Missouri, which is not even a big team, if that team didn't step on that field that day, now there's a president that they asked to resign or they wasn't going to play for 30 years, and before that, those kids that played football actually said that man remained in place. The moment that those kids was not going to play that game, because again, it's free education, as they say, based on something they believe in, that guy was gone.
He was gone.
Because it's a lot bigger than you know, and that's all it takes for one team to say, not any team, just one team, that will throw everything off in the whack in that scenario. Because even the money they would lost from there, but it's so a precedent, like, hey, yeah, whatever they say goes. And when they ask the coach, you know, your player's not going to play, what that coach going to say? No, they better play? He's out of a job. So he got to do the same exact thing. So, again, it comes to the point where athletes now have to see themselves more than just an athlete, as LeBron tries to put that moniker out there. Like, hey, this is my life. I have a short amount of time, a short window in this sport. I'm going to use it like you're trying to use me and understand the things that go along with it, but stop, you know, making decisions based on things that don't matter. Gloves and
Rob,
video
one of the
boards
great things
you
always say
doesn't make any sense.
About an athlete, your youth is your prime time of earning. I think you see it different. That's your leverage while you're young and talented. But the thing is, guys, and Dr. Turner, we're just going to have you back another night because we really didn't even get to explore. We're just getting these guys into college and trying to get them out of college. We really didn't get a chance to get into what happens at the professional level. So, Dr. Turner, I'm going to have to try to get you back at a later date where we can explore that aspect of the athlete. I mean, that your book is NFL Not For Long, The Life and Career of the NFL Athlete, and the work you're doing now in neuroscience, I mean, it's going to be very important down the road.
Well, I would love to come back. You know, I'm coming to Ypsilanti to be at Eastern Michigan on, I think it's the 28th of November. So maybe there'll be an opportunity on that Tuesday before
yes.
then. But sure,
yes.
I would love to be part of your family in a way that can bring to light some of these issues that are covered in the book and questions that, you know, your listeners might have.
Yeah, and I would like to get you and Rob together. I'm going to send your number to Rob and Rob's numbers to you because you guys could probably get together on some issues as well. Mike, any other
absolutely.
Things you'd like to add before we get out of here?
No, that just I was really impressed with the doctor, of course, and I've always impressed with Rob. So it's been a great night, and I learned a lot myself, and I appreciate both of you guys coming on tonight.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. My
and
pleasure.
To our listeners out there, if you're just tuning in, don't worry because we'll download this and put it up on the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com website and the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com webpage so you'll be able to, whatever you miss, you'll be able to catch the rest of that story. Dr. Turner, tell us about where we can get your book, even though we're going to have it on our site, other places they can get it.
Sure. You can find it on Amazon.com. My name is Dr. It's Robert W. Turner II, and the book is entitled Not For Long, The Life and the Career of the NFL Athlete. You can also find it. It's by Oxford University Press. So if you go on Oxford University Press in the academic section, you'll find the book there. And, you know, I'd love to connect with your readers in any way. So in my website is RobertTurnerPhD.com, and they can communicate with me that way.
And we're hoping to, at some point in the future, put up an excerpt from the book on the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com website.
Absolutely. I have it ready, so when you email me, I'll send it right back to you, and it'll be there. And people can find me through Twitter at RobertTurnerPhD. And I'm on Facebook at the same, and I'm also the same thing on Instagram. So I'd love to communicate with people and hear their thoughts.
And Rob, where can people find you and follow you?
Absolutely. So
Robert
you can,
T. Green.
Check out
you
our
got
website,
two, Rob.
postgame.com.
Yeah, I know. That's what I forgot.
Postgame.com. You can also follow on Twitter and Instagram on my personal account at ThePlayersRep, the number 1, all one word. And then also you can follow at Pre-Postgame Inc. on Instagram and on Twitter. So, again, I definitely appreciate you guys having me on, and it was always a pleasure.
Man, great stuff, guys. Until next week, you've been listening to the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com radio show. Michael Robinson, Ricky Hampton, our guest, Dr. Turner, Robert T. Green. Good night. God bless. See you next week.